So, hi everybody, welcome along to our third class on the Two Truths. So, we begin as we normally do by saying some, we do a short meditation, we say some prayers together, and then we actually engage in the class. And during the class, there'll be time for questioning, and there'll also be a section for meditation. Now, please get comfortable in your seat, just move about until you feel quite at ease. Now your back should be straight, your shoulders relaxed, and you can have your eyes open or closed, or even just slightly open. And just let your body breathe itself, just as it does every night when you go to sleep. And while feeling the body breathe itself, just relax into awareness. And imagine that your environment is completely pure, which means that the floor is made of lapis lazuli, crisscrossed with golden squares. The space is full of rainbow light, and there are offerings pouring down through the sky. And in the space in front of you, on a throne with cushions of a lotus, the sun, and the moon, sits the Buddha Shakyamuni. In front of him is His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and in front of him is your own kind teacher. And surrounding them are all the other Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and enlightened beings. Sitting beside you on the left is your mother, and your father is sitting beside you on the right. Other family members and your closest friends are sitting behind you. People that you don't like and people who don't like you, they're sitting directly in front of you. These four groups of people are surrounded by strangers. And you think that you are fortunate to still be alive today. And being alive, you have the leisure and the opportunity to attain your spiritual goals. But you need to act quickly. Your things are not quite right. And there isn't anything that exists as it seems to. But you do have a spiritual friend who is guiding you in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones. So to make manifest the Buddha nature within you and to make this offering of practice purely for the benefit of all sentient beings, see yourself as clear as a deity, holding the Vajra bell and experiencing great bliss. And in seeing the enlightened beings before you, join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened through the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. In response to this prayer of ours, imagine that from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectars stream down, and these dissolve into yourself and into all living beings surrounding you. And your negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Your lifespan and your virtues and your Dharma realizations are increased. So cleansed by wisdom and love, recollect the four immeasurable thoughts and decide to develop these yourself and to establish every other living being within those four boundless states. Then join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Again, from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectars stream down. And these dissolve into yourself and into all living beings surrounding you. Negative karmas and obstructions are removed. Your health and lifespan, your virtues and Dharma realizations are increased. Take a deep breath. Exhale and just relax a little more. But to prevent any type of clinging to either these virtues we've created or to the body or the mind, and to generate these realizations. Join me in saying, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions, accumulated since beginning this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. Again, breathing in, exhaling, relaxing, resting. But without any clinging, imagine that your body takes on the form of the universe itself. You have to offer this to the Buddha and the enlightened beings. And so you say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamriyatayami. So the Buddha accepts your offering. He looks at you and smiles, and you look up into his eyes. And looking into the eyes of the Buddha, you find immense humility, kindness, and acceptance. Now your teacher leaves the merit field, moves through space, and he comes to rest above the crown of your head. He puts his hands together in the prayer mudra. You do the same. And your master makes this request. He asks for the merit field, the Buddhist Bodhisattvas, to pour down inspiring blessings upon you and all mother sentient beings surrounding you, so that all perverse minds might quickly stop, so that the generation of pure minds may begin immediately. And whatever inner, outer, or secret obstructions you have, that these be pacified immediately. And in response to this request again, his lights and nectars pour down from the Buddha, the Bodhisattvas, his holiness, all the enlightened beings. They wash over you and all the beings surrounding you, granting blessings and purifying. And you recollect the three principal aspects of the path. The willingness to give up the causes of suffering or renunciation. The willingness to work for the benefit of all sentient beings and achieve enlightenment, bodhicitta. And the realization of the two truths, the correct view. Now, from the heart of the Buddha, infinite light rays emanate, and they reach all the environments and every being. And all that dissolves into light, which dissolves into the Buddha. And he dissolves into your teacher at the crown of your head. Now, your teacher begins to become smaller and smaller. And he enters through the crown of your head and descends down to your heart. Your mind and the mind of the Lama become one singular nature. Bare face of your innate mind appears. All perceptions of true existence and perceiving it as true have vanished. In this great absence of true existence, you hear the mantra. And hearing it, you begin to recite it. Tayata Om Muni Muni Mahamunaya Soha. Tayata Om Muni Muni Mahamunaya Soha. From your heart, rays of light fill the 10 directions of space. And every sentient being abiding within space is utterly transformed into the fully awakened state. You have accomplished your own purpose and the purpose of others. And from the 10 directions of space, the light begins to withdraw and re-enter your heart. You feel the seat you're sitting on. You can hear traffic passing by. You can feel your body breathing itself. You're embodied once more. Once again, you recollect that this meditation has been one of imagination, which has imprinted the mind. And with further study and practice, this imprint will be awakened, and you will have achieved your purpose of full awakening for the benefit of all beings. Now, breathing through your nostrils. And exhale through your mouth and let your eyes flutter open in your own time. And please move your arms, your feet, your legs. And once again, adjust yourself so you feel quite at ease in your seat. So we look at this course called the Two Truths, and I'm sort of relying mainly on these three books here. And what we've gone through so far. Because last week we looked at these two phenomena called emptiness and dependent origination. And emptiness refers to the ultimate truth, the phenomena, and its realization. whereas dependent origination refers to the conventional truth and its understanding. The week before, we began with the two truths, and we looked at the practical relevance of knowing and what they were and why it's important to know them. So conventional, in the term conventional truth, means ignorance that conceals ultimate reality. It represents this, the cognitive error which obscures the true nature of things. Ultimate truth reveals the emptiness or lack of inherent existence in all things. And ultimate truths are true from the perspective of enlightened beings or Aryas. So an Arya is someone who's already realized the ultimate truth. They've realized or perceptually realized emptiness. So today we're going to look at the understanding and how it's generated of these two truths. So the realization of it goes from a conceptual understanding, which we're gaining in the class, into what's called a direct perception of it. It's a bit like if you've never eaten, say, a guava, for instance, or a piece of fruit, an exotic piece of fruit. You hear the name, you go, what's that? And they say, oh, it's this new fruit. So, well, I've never heard of it. So the person tells you all about the fruit. Right? So that means you've got a conceptual understanding of the fruit. You still don't know what it tastes like. Then the next week, they bring you in a piece of the fruit and you have a taste of it. And now you know. So this is what we're talking about here. So we are getting a conceptual understanding of these two truths. And then we have a perceptual understanding of it. The perceptual understanding takes place mentally. Conventional truths can be realized just with your eyes, your tongue, with your normal senses. And so this, how I'm going to explain this, we're going to do the first part is will be about the conceptual, and then how we move from the conceptual to the direct experience, or what are called paths. So a path, there are two major paths, or you have a path when you have firm renunciation. So paths are described from two perspectives. One is from the perspective of your own personal liberation, and the other is from the perspective of enlightenment or Buddhahood. From the perspective of your own liberation, the path is called renunciation. And this is when you have a firm and effortless wish to no longer cause suffering for yourself. So you know what causes suffering, and you have this natural wish to abandon those causes. So for instance, if you knew deeply how much anger hurt you, then you'd go, okay, I'm never going to be angry again. And that's what's driving you through the rest of this life. So you just work out all the things that afflict you and make life really difficult, and you realize, I don't want to do that anymore. I'm not going to do that anymore. What do I need to do to stop it? Once that's sort of natural and effortless to you, you've entered a path. This is called a path of renunciation. Now, there's another vehicle, the Mahayana vehicle. This is the one we're talking about primarily today. There's a path there. This path is called the path of bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment. And this has to arise spontaneously. Doesn't require any more thinking. You get to it through a lot of thinking and behavior changing, and then it's always with you. Again, this is a bit like learning to drive a car and reading the book about the rules of traffic. So you do all that, takes quite a lot of effort, and then you start driving the car. And sometimes you might have to remember, you know, you have to really think, oh, what do I do here? I need to stop, you know, what's going on? Especially for beginners, that's how it sort of works. But if you've been driving 10, 15 years, you don't do that anymore, do you? You just naturally know what to do. And this is the same with the mind of enlightenment. That's the progression. You come to these classes, you think it through, you hear all the teachings, you gradually put it into practice and think and you think and you realize, if I could become a Buddha, I would actually have accomplished my own purpose, the deepest purpose. I'd have the greatest sense of happiness. I'd be able to effortlessly help others. That's what I want to do. And it's like it's always with you. It'd be as if you were a prisoner in a jail and you always wanted to get out and you want to go home. But you don't need to have lots of reasons. That's just how you feel about it. And bodhicitta's like that. Once it's there, you have the path. And these two paths. Now, these paths are made up of different stages. So you have the stage where you have either renunciation or bodhicitta, but you don't have the wisdom realizing emptiness. So you need to practice. And then it's a thing called the path of seeing. And that's where you have the direct perceptual understanding of emptiness. You see, my God, everything's empty. That's called the path of seeing. And then there's another path, next one from this, called the path of meditation, where you do it again and again and again. And through doing it again and again and again, you wipe out the actual deepest causes of your suffering so that they no longer appear. You do it for quite some time and you finally attain the state of being. So the path is made up of different stages. You have two stages, or two paths before you see reality, but you do have bodhicitta or renunciation. And then there's what happens after, the path of seeing and the path of meditation. So we'll talk about this, what we're going to basically talk about. Is there anything that I've muddied or made murky for you, made difficult? So is it reasonably clear for you? So we always begin with what's called study and reflection. So here you all are studying, right? Just like me, I'm still studying. And reflection means thinking. And the study and reflection is to make clear to ourselves what this path means and how do I engage in it. Right? So like we said, you know, like me, you probably read books. You're on the internet, you're looking, you're listening, you come along to classes. And you ask lots of questions. And you're getting the answers and trying to make sense of them. And you're also trying to work in harmony with them. Like, for instance, if you decide, you know, so you did that for a while, then you might decide, gee, this thing called Buddhism seems okay to me. I might make that my way of life. You don't have to, but if you make that decision, then you take refuge. So, well, now I consider myself a Buddhist. And so what should I do? The first thing they probably say is, look, do your very, very best not to hurt anybody. But stop harming people. Don't take the things that haven't been given to you. In other words, stealing things. Don't break up marriages or relationships. So you'll hear all that, and it's based on reasoning. So you'll think about it. Yeah. And you decide, yeah, I'm not going to do those things. So you've actually, you know, now you're a Buddhist. Have you entered a path yet? No, but you are a Buddhist. And you know that there are these paths that you need to generate. This first one will be the one you're trying to get is either renunciation or bodhicitta. So if you're going for bodhicitta, renunciation is subsumed within it. If you're just going for your own personal liberation, you don't need bodhicitta. You just need renunciation. You've got to stop causing yourself problems. Now, if you want to become a Buddha with bodhicitta, you've got to do the same. It's just primarily for the benefit of others. The other one is primarily for your benefit. And so what are you studying and reflecting upon? Well, the two truths, method and wisdom, emptiness and dependent arising. So the study and the reflection of these two truths enable realization of them. And this study and the realizations are conceptual. In other words, that's brought about through you thinking. But this conceptual understanding is really, really important. It's a conventional truth. But remember, without conventional truths, you can't have an ultimate truth. So this is, it's important to study, to think, to reflect. As you do, you'll know, my gosh, this is everything I'm understanding is dependent on how I study, where I study, who I study with. So you see, that's a dependent arising. We go from last, whatever's dependent is empty of any intrinsic nature. Everything is empty of an intrinsic nature is dependent. So you've got the two truths right there working. You're working with them already. It takes a bit of time to realize that, but you are. And these conceptual understandings are the foundation for the wisdom and the methods that we will come to understand more deeply. So the way that I've had it explained to me is that we start with the two truths, and on the basis of the two truths, we learn about the Four Noble Truths. And within the Four Noble Truths are the method and the wisdom to bring about our freedom. We have the freedom means Buddhahood, or the state of being an Arya, meaning no more suffering, no more uncontrolled rebirths taking place. So our conceptual understandings, these sort of initiate our spiritual journey. We understand things, we go, that makes sense to me, that's right, so I'm taking it, I'm working with that. Meditation sort of transforms these understandings into direct realizations. So in other words, so we read, we think, and we draw correct conclusions. And then what we've got to do is become really familiar with that correct conclusion, that correct idea. That's what meditation's about. Becoming familiar and familiarity and cultivating of positive mental states. That's the purpose of the meditation. But before you do that, we need to reflect and we need to study, listen, talk to others, work it out. Now, as this is about this class is primarily about the realization of an understanding of these two truths. In other words, we're going to be really learning about dependent arising, the whole method side of it. In other words, like how things exist, what actually exists, and what do we do with that knowledge? And then the other side, this wisdom realizing emptiness, the deepest nature of all of that, what we understand, how the things exist, what exists. So Lama Tsongkhapa, the founder of our tradition, says, appearances are infallible, dependent arising. Emptiness is the understanding that is free of assertions. While these two are seen as distinct, we have not yet realized the intent of the Buddha. So what this verse is sort of getting at is that emptiness and dependent arising are inseparable. They're like one phenomenon. They're joined at the hip. But they're not two opposite things. So in this first line here, Lama Tsongkhapa said that whatever does exist arises through causes and conditions, appearing reliably yet lacking or empty of the inherent existence they seem to have. And this infallibility, it says, appearances are infallible, dependent arising. So infallibility refers to their conventional functionality. Now, ordinary things, everything we see with our senses and so on, it all functions, doesn't it? And it has no intrinsic nature whatsoever. That's what it's saying. It doesn't need intrinsic nature. It just needs to dependently arise and it works. So emptiness is the understanding that's free of assertion. So the assertion is they have inherent existence, the belief that they exist in the way they appear to you. So emptiness isn't a nihilism, but a freedom from the sort of rigid assertions about inherent reality. It negates intrinsic existence, not the conventional functionality of things. That's left alone. And to see these two phenomena, emptiness and dependent arising, as two distinct phenomena, That's a mistake. This perpetuates a dualism to see these two truths as being two separate phenomena. So every phenomenon is both a dependent arising and empty. You and I, we are dependent arisings and we're empty at the very same time. Yes, Debbie.
Eddie, I think it's really interesting how, like, when I first came to, was introduced to emptiness, my mind was just like, this thing that I see so solid. So if it's not like that, it just doesn't exist at all. Like, our mind is just so black and white when it comes to it. So I've, it's taken me so long just to come to that point that they're not, there doesn't, just because something doesn't exist inherently doesn't mean it doesn't exist at all. It's taken so much time to get to that middle point.
Yeah, and this is so what Debbie just said. This is what we're getting at here about why it takes quite a bit of time to get first of all, a conceptual understanding, a correct conceptual understanding. We have conceptualities, ideas, and thoughts, but many of the sort of takes a bit of time to move from the wrong state to the correct state. There's your senses to grasp at it all wrongly. It's been doing it for a long time, it just keeps doing it. So it takes a bit of time to sort of think it through. Think it, oh, it's all mistaken. That's a mistake. But there are these, so here, this which deals with this phenomenon that Demi has raised. It takes quite some time to realize that if phenomena are not inherently existent, it does not mean they don't exist. It means they dependently exist. It takes a bit of time to get your head around that. The way you do that is through this analytical meditation. So when you do the analysis, there are different types of reasoning you can use. Probably the very best, what they call the king of reasons, the easiest one is the reasoning of dependent arising, dependent origination. If you use that, you don't slip off into nihilism. Because you're already working with something that does exist. You're working with existent phenomena. Whereas if you start off with emptiness, you can be a bit hard to come back out on the other side and get the dependent arising again. So in other words, reasoning is essential for the development of this wisdom that liberates you. And there are three types, not three, I think there's five or six ways of doing this, of realizing the emptiness. So I think last week we looked at two ways of emptiness of the person and phenomena, then one of the emptiness of phenomena themselves in terms of their production, and the last two are just on the emptiness of the phenomena. So there's five there, but here I'll just mention three. So the first, like I said, the easiest one is dependent origination. And this reasoning asserts that all phenomena arise due to causes and conditions lacking an independent existence. So you just start looking around and go, does that phenomena depend upon causes and conditions? If it does, you will know that it's empty of an independent nature. Again, so as Holiness says, a simple way, just because these terms are new to us, we have this term called intrinsic existence, inherent nature. These terms, we're not really familiar with them. You probably ask, like, what does that mean? So the simplest thing is to go not dependent. Independent. The word independent means not dependent, doesn't it? Your parents are sort of saying, I can't wait for my kids to get out of here. It's like, they'll be independent, not dependent on me. So you've got not dependent. And on the other side, you've got dependent. They're opposites, aren't they? So not dependent means inherent nature, intrinsic nature, all these other terms I'm saying. And what you need to do is just take any phenomenon you like and ask yourself, in what way is this phenomenon not dependent upon something else? And you can't find anything that's dependent. The offer is dependent upon you apprehending it, right? Like it's dependent upon your own awareness to see it, to know it. Then it's dependent upon the language you use to name it and to describe it. It's dependent upon its parts. It's dependent upon causes and conditions. So if you can find something that doesn't depend upon cause and conditions, parts, and the name and consciousness, you have found something that is not dependent. You go, Buddha was wrong. I found something. But what you find, you don't find that. What you find is dependence. Whatever it is depends upon something else. And you go, okay, I've got it. So then it doesn't have this independent, it doesn't have this not dependent. So not having is the empty. Just like saying my purse has no money in it. This phenomenon has no inherent existence with it. It doesn't have that quality. It's not there. And saying that does not mean to say the clock doesn't exist or we don't exist. It just says this quality is not there. It's empty of inherent existence, not that it's not existent. So we can use dependent origination. The other one is not inherently one, not inherently many. So you can say this clock here is not inherently one thing. You're like, why? He says, well, it's got parts. So in a way, you're right. So there's the other one is it's not inherently many either. There's not inherently many clocks here, is there? It's just one clock. So it's not inherently one, it's not inherently many. There's the only two, there's nothing else. So it's not inherently existent then. It's not inherently one and not inherently many. It is not inherently existent. The last one is another one called freedom from the four extremes. Where in that way, what you do is you take these phenomena and say, okay, I'm just going to assume that it has inherent existence, as it appears to have. And you can ask yourself, is it inherently existent? Is it inherently existent? Is it not? Is it both? Is it neither? There are the four ways of looking at something, and if you can't, there's no inherent existence, you go, then it doesn't inherently exist. So again, you say, okay, so it must, since it's there, it does exist, it must exist dependently. So different methods, you just find the one that suits you, get it down, all the stuff's in the books, it's quite straightforward. You just go through it. And what's really fun is to do it on yourself, right? To do your own feeling of self. You go, oh my God, there it is. That my sense of self, that is appearing to be not dependent upon my body and mind. That's it. I've got it. Intrinsic self. But I've identified it. Now I've got to check and see if it actually exists in that way. So I've got appearance and existence. Now we do the checking. Now, so when we try to move from conceptual to non-conceptual, it requires more than just the study. We need to do more. It's a lot of work. So just reading, thinking, listening, meditating, that's all good, but we need even more. And what we need more of is things like ethics. The ability to actually concentrate the mind, to keep it on this analysis, this path of analysis. Different types of wisdom, the wisdom that arises from hearing, the wisdom that arises from reflection, the wisdom that arises from meditation. This wisdom itself, the wisdom of emptiness, guru yoga. All of these phenomena really help. Now, to think that this part here is just all religion, so I don't need that. I just need to think it through. I've got a good mind. I can do it. It won't work for you. It's never worked for anyone else. So you need what they call supporting practices. Why do you think ethics might be, it's actually the foundation. Without ethics, you're not going to get realized emptiness. Yeah, you don't have fear. So you do need to have a sort of a peaceful mind, right? To do this. To concentrate on this. Otherwise, just like Sandy said, you might start off like that, but then you're worried that the police are going to kick the door in, or when are they going to catch me? Or these things are going to happen to me because of what I've done in the past. That's always going to interrupt you, so you don't want that sort of stuff. Yeah, so with ethics too, so what you find, so most other religions, it's like Ethics is the foundation, isn't it? Religions that they're founded on ethical behavior. Yeah? And Buddhism is really founded on the wisdom. The ethics come out of the wisdom, and then the ethics support the nourishment of the wisdom. So it's more of a circular type thing. It's quite a strange thing. So if I look back in my life, I've never been a very ethical person. I've got myself in lots and lots of trouble. But then, when I first came to the teachings, this was the thing that really struck me, the wisdom realizing emptiness. I walked into the class, I didn't know what Geshe was talking about, the Four Noble Truths. I don't know what he's saying. But I sat there, and then he started talking about this, and my head really jumped off my shoulders. I went, got it. That's what I want to hear. That's what I've been missing all my life. And it all made sense to me. Right? But of course, you have to hear it again just to make sure you're not completely wrong. But from that came this realization of an ethical stance. It's like, oh my God, it's the only response left, kindness. Once you realize that all things are empty of any intrinsic nature, that everything is interconnected, then kindness is the smartest move you can make, right? Smartness and compassion. That comes out of it. So then I went, oh, okay. That makes real good sense to me about why you abandon behaviors that hurt others. You go, well, why would you do it? Because you know when you hurt others, you hurt yourself. Is that straightforward? So there's a dependent relationship here. Cause and effect. Okay, I get it, right. I see where this is coming from. It doesn't mean to say you've got to realize emptiness first before you become an ethical person, because everybody's sort of different. But just like you said, Sandy, ethics, if you don't get emptiness pretty quickly and dependent arising, you just go, okay, I'm you know, look, this requires a lot of thinking and stability. I don't want stuff hanging over me. I don't want to be thinking about. In fact, one of the first things that happened to me when I sort of got an inkling about the interest in dependent arising was I rang up the first girl I fell in love with, right? So I fell in love with her when she was 11, and I was 11 too. But of course, you don't know very much when you're 11. And she was really shy, and so was I. And I didn't realize she was shy. So I thought she was deliberately having nothing to do with me. And it got me so upset that I sort of lashed out at her, right? And tried to hurt her. And as soon as I did it, I felt really bad. Oh my God, I felt really guilty and ashamed of what I've done. But I didn't know how to say sorry either. Anyway, it was sitting with me for like 30 years. Right? And then when I came across this, I thought, that still affects me, and I do not want to die like that. I do not want to have that thought on my mind before I die. So I rang her up and said, hi, and she said, I remember you. You were really sweet on me. I said, yeah, I was. And I want to say I'm really sorry for what I said to you. And she said, what would you say? I said, well, I said, what? I said, this. He said, oh, no, I never heard that. Never happened. Because I was such a sneaky young fella, I didn't say this bad thing to her myself. I got my best mate to tell her girlfriend, tell Anne. Well, her girlfriend went, I'm not saying that to my best mate. And said nothing. So this girl I was sweet on never ever heard the harsh words that I said, but I got affected by it. There's dependent arising, there's karma in play. It made sort of understanding, my God, how you can hurt yourself. So of course I thought, oh, thank God, like it's not a complete karma, but nevertheless, it affected me for 30 odd years. You know? And when this happened, I sort of got, some understanding about karmic, like karma and dependent arising and all that sort of stuff. And this is what can happen to you too. Like, you can look at yourself, you make mistakes all through life, right? But none of these mistakes intrinsically exist. and they don't maintain any intrinsic existence. So it's like what you've done in the past, you can get rid of that right now. How it affects you now. Anyway, something to think of, think about. There's quite a lot to do to realize emptiness perceptually. Now, the relevance of all this is, first of all, so the conceptual understanding prepares the mind for the actual realization of it. So just knowing and understanding, it's not enough. We have to sort of like realize it deeply. So it has this deep impact on us. So what, but on the way, you regulate your emotions. If you understand your emotions dependently arise, you can interfere. You can start playing around so that those emotions don't arise. So you regulate your feelings. Of course, ethical decision making, like I said before, ethics flows out of dependent arising and emptiness. And of course, it supports resilience. If you know that all phenomena are empty of intrinsic nature, they're also impermanent. Anything that's produced is impermanent, so it will change. You won't, there's nobody in here, me included, could ever maintain a hateful state of mind like for a long time. No one can. The reason for that is so simple is because hate depends upon a whole lot of other conditions. If those conditions aren't there, you can't be experiencing it. You can't experience it. So you have moments of sort of peace, relaxation. Then you've got to generate it again, don't you? You know, so it requires these conditions. You've got to think it up. You've got to come up with all your reasons for hating somebody. And oftentimes, we forget, right? So we're okay again. We've got to generate it again. So just knowing that, you can alter them. You can alter these negative states. You can also build on the positive ones because these phenomena don't exist independently. They're not just sitting out there and somehow they get you. You have to create them. You can create the good, you can mess up the good too. You create the bad and you can destroy the bad. And of course, all relationships are enhanced with the understanding of dependent arising. They're all saying a happy wife, a good life. Right? So there you've got dependent arising, isn't it? A happy life depends upon you having a happy wife. Right? So there's plenty of little things like that, you know, and you go, oh yeah. Plays it out all the time. So I'll just pause here and ask you guys, is there anything you'd like to ask or add or just kidding?
Just from your last point of enhancing relationships, I find that I don't blame my family and my partner as much for my upset. I
Yeah.
kind of go, oh, that's mine. I've got to take care of that. It's not actually them doing anything.
Yeah, it's so. Yeah, so one of the real big realizations you get of this is that the primary cause for your suffering and happiness is not out there. It's not out there. It's primarily to do with your own mind. It's the mind that decides, or ignorance. It's a virtuous mind that decides for your happiness, and it's an ignorant mind that doesn't really know what it's doing, that takes the other track. Sandy, you're going to say? Yeah, so you might see this often like in court cases or even in the news, often in the news, and there's always this idea of painting one side black, evil. Right? And it's like they are intrinsically bad, evil. They're not. Nobody's intrinsically anything. You often hear the media or often in trials, somebody's seen as a monster. They're not human. They're trying to paint this picture so we see them as completely evil. Nobody is. Okay, so let's do our first meditation then. Okay, so just get comfortable in the seat. And if you like, just gently close your eyes. And let your breath be normal and natural. Just let the breath anchor you to this present moment. And within this present, bring your attention inward. With each exhalation of breath, release tension from the body. Let your mind become like a still pond which reflects the sky. So why is it that we seek clarity in our lives? Why do we seek clarity in our lives? Well, it might be because clarity allows us to see things as they are. Free from any distortion. So we're going to explore the concept of conventional truth, the way things appear in our everyday experience. The conventional truth is the lens through which we navigate the world. Yet it's not the whole picture. So when we understand conventional truth, we see that our perceptions often exaggerate or misinterpret reality. Realizing this, we could soften our emotional reactions and cultivate a sense of calmness. I imagine the world is appearing quite blurry to you. And you put on some glasses, and everything becomes clear and precise. In the same way, understanding the two truths, conventional and ultimate, is like wearing such glasses. I want you to just ask this question of yourself. How does perception shape the experience of reality? Like a painter choosing a palette, our views color our actions and our emotions. What happens when we hold on to rigid beliefs? There's often tension and conflict. But when we see the fluidity of the interconnections within life, then we can become adaptable. We become like water which just flows around obstacles. So when we see that phenomena exist dependently, how can we apply this insight? What might we do with this insight? And with the knowledge of dependent arising, dependent relationship, dependent imputation, you can act with wisdom and greater compassion. Once you know that all phenomena exist dependently, there's a sort of a release of the rigidity that you often hold. So you need to try to hold on this clear idea of dependency, dependent arising. So to carry the view of dependent relationship, dependent interconnectedness into life. And let this view guide you towards sort of balance and awareness. And breathing in through your nostrils. Exhale. Let your eyes flutter open. And again, just adjust your posture in your seat so you feel quite comfortable. The next part, the last part of this class, we're going to talk about how we move from concept to perception, direct from sort of idea into direct insight. Yeah, so one of the things you'll discover with when you adopt the view of dependent arising is that you'll realize how little you know. That for things to exist, they depend upon so many other phenomena, and we only know a little bit about it, a little bit of some of those things. So just moving beyond concepts. This is about, like I said, about learning to ride a bike. You study the mechanics. This is an understanding of it. You watch people who probably are already riding bikes. You might try and get on them, and it's very hard to balance. You need a lot of help. But becoming really familiar with riding a bike, you have to ride it, don't you? You actually have to practice riding it and enjoy it. You have to like it. It's the same here. Once you understand this, you start liking it. You see all the relationships, the dependencies. Not only, so in the ordinary world, there's always dependent arisings, but you're sort of more relaxed about it all. When you do the meditations, none of that's going to appear. Everything just falls away, and what you're left with is your own awareness, and there's nothing appearing to you but just the emptiness of the phenomena. The phenomena you thought were there, they're not there. They have no intrinsic nature, so they can't appear. And it's arresting. So the mind rests from all the wrong concepts that it used to have about the nature of phenomena. And they call this peaceful. In fact, it's a great homage to the Buddha, where one of the lines goes, I praise the perfect Buddha, the best of all teachers, who taught that which dependently originates is without cessation, without production, and so forth. And it goes down, and it goes through eight phenomena that all phenomena don't have. All these phenomena don't have any intrinsic nature. And at the end, he says, and peaceful, free from conceptual fabrications. So what it means is, it's why is it the phenomena have never had intrinsic existence. That has been a fabrication of the mind. The mind has made that up. And you seeing directly that that fabrication is not there. And that's a state of rest and peace. In fact, one of the things that when the Buddhist really discovered this, he said, I found something so marvelous, I don't know how anyone will ever believe me. Or how I could even explain it to them. So I'm not going to. I'm going to go off to the forest and just sit there and keep it to myself. That's how the story goes. And he was sort of woken up by the gods, and out of their compassion, they said, "Look, everybody's mind is not so obscured. Someone could get this. Come out here and teach." So our progress requires the merging of the conceptual understanding with the meditative insight. Well, I'm going to talk now about how we do that. And here's where we talk about the paths. And so we have to let's imagine ourselves, for instance. So suppose that we were saying, okay, I want to realize the two truths. You say, why do you want to do that, Eddie? Or Sue, or whoever you are, you're just saying this to yourself, why do you want to do that? And you say, well, I want to put an end to my own suffering. And I want to stop everybody else suffering too. So you go, ah, okay, you're bodhicitta, you've entered the path. So, in other words, you've studied enough to have this, can I say, natural wish. Now you go, okay, so how am I going to do that? I need to realize emptiness. And you would have known that already because you've been studying. But now you go, but no, I have to actually really know it. I have to actually have the experience of it. I need to perceive it directly myself, not just know about okay, good. So how do you do that? You say, well, on this path, it's called the path of accumulation. The accumulation is like you're gathering stuff, isn't it? You're getting stuff. What's the stuff you're getting? The knowledge of emptiness. I'm accumulating my knowledge through study and through reflection. That's what you're primarily doing here. Like you might be doing now, right? You go home, you think about this, you read more. You're not on the path of accumulation, but you are accumulating. And then none of that goes to waste. So once you have the mind that seeks enlightenment, all this knowledge about emptiness is not lost. It's like, wow, I've got all that and I'm on the path now. So, has anybody read the Heart Sutra or heard it? Do you know what the mantra is? Yeah, Gate Gate Paragate Parasangate Bodhisattva. So the first Gate means go. Go to this path. Go to this path of accumulation. And the second go means once you're on that path, go to the next path. Prepare yourself to actually see emptiness. So that path's called the path of preparation. And how do you do that? This is where you get, now, okay, you've got a correct understanding of what the word emptiness means and why phenomena are empty. That's correct. But there's still, when you sit down and meditate on it, it's like you're still here and the object is still there. It's like there's this gap, just like there is now when you start thinking, right? There's always a me that's thinking. So you've got this correct idea, you're like, okay, and what's going to happen over time is that the object and subject, you and your knowledge of emptiness, are going to meet because you're empty and emptiness is empty. There's no actual barrier there, the barrier is conceptual. So you start off with you've got this idea of the phenomenon of emptiness. What are you applying this knowledge of emptiness to? Well, to yourself. To yourself and to every other type of phenomena, but the most important phenomena is the mind. So you see, there's no actual separation between you and your own mind. The barrier is conceptual. I exist conceptually. What never was a real thing, and neither was your mind. They were both empty of that type of real reality. That intrinsic reality. They've always been empty of it. And now you realize it. And when that happens, you're on the path of seeing. And so you go one, two. So you prepare here on these two truths, study, meditation, insight. Then you directly see it. So when it first happens to you, this is called now you're on the path of seeing, para, gati, gati, paragati. So you've gone beyond the two previous paths, the Paragati in that mantra. But now you're seeing. Now the seeing is so quick. Like I said before, it's like the idea of somebody telling you about a fruit. You know all about it, but you've never eaten it. But as soon as that taste goes in, you've got it, right? That's it. It's like that. There's this ball, it's like you've broken through. And now there seems to be, there's no inherently existent you, and there's no inherently existent emptiness. It's just empty. You're experiencing it. So depending upon how long you develop your concentration, you stay in there for a little bit, and then you come out of it. Each of these stages, the path of accumulation, the path of preparation, the path of seeing, they're also made up of paths too. So the first path of accumulating the knowledge is made up of three parts. The path of preparation is about four parts. When you actually have the seeing, there's actual seeing. In the very next moment, you're still within it, but you've gone beyond it. Now you're in the path of meditation. So the path of seeing is only one moment. You see it the very second moment, you're meditating on it. You're becoming familiar with it. So now you're on the path of meditation. And what that does immediately is, I think they say there's 108 wrong views that you have that will never ever come back. They were just conceptual wrong ideas, and they're gone. They're finished. So now what's the path of meditation to do then? You had these wrong ideas, but now you've got these different emotional afflictions, right? Our stuff, right? The emotions that drive us. They've all been rooted in the wrong idea of inherent existence. We need to go back there, and just this wisdom will uproot it. You see, it never was there. And you just go through stages and stages on the path of meditation, just sort of deepening your realization. Now, so while you're in that state, so you stay in it for as long as you are able to and can do it, then you'll come back out of it. So when you come out of it, what you've realized there is not lost, right? That's with you all the time now. But you're back out in this world, right? And everybody's going to be just like here, like they are now. When you're in that meditative state, they're not. Nothing appears in that state but emptiness. There are no conventionally existent phenomena in that state. It does not mean they exist. They don't exist. It means that your focus is on emptiness, not people or cars or any other phenomena. You only see the emptiness. When you open up your eyes, the emptiness vanishes. Conventional appearances come back. But your knowledge that they're empty, that doesn't go, that stays. And so then you take this idea, wow, I'm looking at all phenomena, and start to take, say, they're like visions, they're like dreams, they're like mirages. They've got all these different metaphors that you can use. So I was thinking of this one this morning, I was sort of going, wow, I think something happened this morning to me. But I was thinking about this little story now about how the middle way consequence, so that when you come out of your realization of emptiness and you come back in the world, things don't look the same to you. I mean, they're all appearing there, but your knowledge of them is quite different now. And so how do you train yourself with this disparity between what you know and how things appear to be? You slowly look at them as if they're like mirages. So I'm sitting there thinking, okay, so when you look at a mirage, suppose you see a mirage of trees and water. What appears to you when you're looking at that mirage?
Trees and water.
Trees and water. That's right, trees and water appear, don't they? Any mirage that you look at, if it's a mirage of trees and water, that's what's appearing to you, isn't it? But if you know that's a mirage, what else do you know about that? Yes, which means that they're
Empty.
are trees and water. Right? There's trees and water there appearing to you, but there's no actual tree there and there's no actual water there, right? That's what you know, right? You go, okay, I know that's the mirage. Now, what about me? What about the people? You go, well, it looks like there's a person there, but there is no actual person there when I look in the appearance. Like yourself, right? So this is why you start with yourself. You go, okay, So when I get upset, myself pops up, right? Doesn't it? I say, I'm upset. You go, are you talking about your body, Ed? And you go, no, me. Your mind? No, me. I'm upset. I'm really upset. Right? So this appearance of an I. Right? When you go to look, there's no I there. Just like there's no water and trees in the mirage. There's no I in the body. There's no I in the mind. There's no I outside them. There's no I that has a body and a mind. That's what you know. This is the mirage, right? Really looks like there is a real, really feels like there's a real me there. But that's the mirage. That's what you understand. You discover there's no real me, no intrinsic me, no independent me through your analysis, and you actually got to see it. But yet when you come out here, you're going to see everybody looking just like they do. Everybody's looking at you as if you're really there too. That's the mirage. It doesn't mean to say I don't exist. I do. I still exist. Just not like that. Just like mirages exist, but not like they've got actual water and trees. So you can say, so what's here? You go, well, my body and mind. It's called I, me. I'm right here. Just like that mirage is right there with this tree and water, but no real tree, no real water. It's like no real me here. Just the name called me. Just the name put on the phenomena of trees and water called mirage. Now there's the dependent arising and the empty of the intrinsic nature. So you keep doing this and this idea. So like I said, you do the meditation, absolutely nothing but the empty appears. It says no appearances other than the emptiness. So emptiness does exist. It exists because it can be known. But it's not a thing. But it's just like I say, like your mind, right? We talk about it as a thing, but it's got no thingness about it at all. It's completely empty of any thingness. So that you always get there's the discrepancy. You open your eyes up, wow, look, it's right all here. But again, I've got a great metaphor for this when they say, so do stars exist? Tell me, do the stars exist? Yeah, of course they do. If you go outside and have a look for them, will you see any? No. Does it mean that they don't exist? No. It's the same with the emptiness. No. You don't see an eye that exists. Intrinsically. Does it mean that you don't exist? No. It means you don't intrinsically exist. Yeah. So it's just like the light out there, you don't see the stars. The light has to come down, now the stars appear. Yeah. So they still exist, but not intrinsically. So the stars exist, they're out there, but they're obscured by the light, don't they? They need dark, you need the darkness to see them, not the light. The light will obscure them. Now, so that's it how for us. So for a long, long time, it's always going to be like that. But like I said, we're not fooled by the appearances of inherent existence. We are behaving kindly, rationally, wise, because that's the most sensible thing to do with dependent arising. This goes on until actually it stops and you become a Buddha and you see it at the very same time. So here Lama Tsongkhapa says, furthermore, appearances refute the extreme of existence and emptiness refutes the extreme of non-existence. When you understand that the emptiness arises in the form of causes and effect, you are not captivated by the view of extremes. There's a very peculiar verse here, and often it's said the other way around. And the other way around is really easy to understand. But Lama Tsongkhapa reversed it. And it's still understandable, still makes sense. It says that emptiness refutes the extreme of non-existence. That's right. Emptiness is things dependently exist, not they don't exist. Yeah, that's right. This is why Lama Tsongkhapa says coming through dependent arising. It's obvious. Right? When you become an emptiness, it's a little. a lot of thinking. You try and draw this experience. So you just use the appearances. They tell you straight away. Now, like I said, the Buddha is different for them at Buddhahood. So what for them is like things both appear at once. The conventional nature, so for us, it's like the conventional nature is appearing, it's right here in front of us, but it's appearing as if it has an intrinsic existence. It appears that way. We should know that it doesn't have that type of existence. For the Buddha, that appearance of intrinsic reality does not appear. The conventionalities do, but not the inherent nature. And their compassion is arising because they know God, of course, sentient beings, they don't see what I see. They see it the other way around. Not only do they see it the other way around, they believe it's true. And yet from us, that's the real foundation for compassion to arise. So, oh my God, nobody really knows what they're doing. And you can't blame them. That's what I like to say. You don't blame the people, you blame the ignorance. If you want to blame anything, it's ignorance. It's throwing up a wrong appearance and they're saying, believe it. It's true. It's like that story of the Wizard of Oz, remember? He goes behind the curtain at the end. Like that. This is our mind doing. No evidence does it have. Yeah, so both truths are unified aspects of reality. In terms of its practical relevance, so the direct realization transcends conceptual understanding, yet it includes it. In other words, I was about to swear then, but it's a simple way of saying it. But you're making stuff up. You're making everything up. It's not a bad thing, it's just the way it is. You make up good stuff, you make up bad stuff. It has an effect on it and on others too. The good, making it up, that's the conceptual stuff. What we call the fabrication. But when you know that you're doing that, this is where equanimity comes in really well. When you know that enemies don't truly exist, neither do friends, your aversion towards enemies drops, your attachment to the friends drops. You sort of take an equanimous view. The other one I like about this is when you see that we're basically the same. Like all of us are without an inherently existing self. None of us has one. The vast majority of us believe and act as if we do. So we're the same. So they were both creating hells and heavens all the time. We're the same. And if that's the case, and you look at the same, you go, well, so I've got this responses I can make. I could go with aversion and hatred and hurt, or I could go the other side. Again, your relationships improve. If you know, for instance, that all the qualities that you see in the beloved are primarily imputed by you. You'll never find them existing from the side of the object. They're not there like that. It's so much easier. And is it better to have like a good mindset about the person you're with than a bad one? So yeah, your relationships do improve. Greater freedom. That's just follows on. And of course, the practice deepens. Because you do, well, it makes sense. It's truthful, it's honest. You can't fault it. I mean, you should try to fault it, but that's the thing, but you won't be able to. But you should try, just in case it's not true. If you understood that if you have children and your children are really upset, right, you wouldn't get upset at them. Because you understand that they're in the grip of an emotional affliction. The stuff I talked about the paths, there's a lot in it. Of course, I just want to give you a really brief overview and look at it, go, this is how you do it, right? And the outcomes of doing it. We could do our final meditation. The time's just about up. But again, just sit comfortably, drop your shoulders. Let yourself relax and close your eyes if you like. So here we're going to explore the two truths. Let your body breathe itself, and let your breath just guide you to a sense of calm awareness. So we want to understand these two truths and cultivate knowledge of them to put it into our own suffering and the suffering that others experience. We want to put an end to the suffering of self and other to bring about the fullest potential that we have. The conventional truth that reflects the surface experiences of life. The ultimate truth reveals their empty nature and their interconnectedness. Together, these two truths, they're like observing the ocean waves while sensing the calm depths below. The waves, the surface shows the fluctuations of life. The deeper truth, the ultimate, shows the fundamental stillness. Now, what does this dual perception of the two truths mean? It means noticing the transient nature of experience. Or recognizing a deeper depth. It's like watching storm clouds pass over the ocean without disturbing the depths of the ocean. How does knowledge of emptiness help in daily life? So it helps loosen attachment to fixed identities, fosters resilience, and it frees us up to respond authentically, kindly, compassionately, firmly, if necessary. So why are both truths essential? The conventional truth acts like a map to navigate the forest of our reality. But the ultimate truth is like the living wilderness itself. It's like the ultimate truth is the actual territory, and the map is just a conceptual construct, a guide. I try to carry this dual awareness of phenomena into daily life. Notice the surface appearances while sensing the interconnected stillness beneath. And just breathing in our three nostrils and exhaling. So when I say this, you know, notice the surface appearances while sensing the interconnected stillness beneath, I'm not talking about the things out there. I'm talking about your own mind. Like, you know, you really, I mean, whatever you're seeing, it's not separate from your mind, is it? I mean, straight away it affects your mind, right? Visual consciousness or mental consciousness, there's no real gap there. So when we kind of, if you think, oh, there's a terrible phenomena happening out there in the world, the terrible phenomena is happening in here, with your mind. But you need to understand that, that's just the surface. You know, like I said, the appearances go across the surface, but beneath it's empty, deep, open. So in brief, try to put this together before reacting, like catch yourself, right? Don't get, come back to the stillness. And you can do that by this very simple way. Ask yourself, is what I believe true? What's beyond your first impressions? So next week, we're going to be looking at these different ways of looking at this reality. How do different philosophical schools in Buddhism relate to these two truths? So you might find it like very surprising what they do. Anyway, I'd love to share it with you. So I'll hope you'll be here and you'll participate in the class again. We have come to the end of our class. So let's dedicate our effort in listening and thinking and reflecting. So, you know, dedicate your effort to enlightenment for your own benefit and the benefit of all beings. And then say with me, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel, Bodhicitta, not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. A prayer for his holiness and his long life. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And finally, for the finding of the rebirth of the person once known as Lamasloka Prashe. In holding and spreading the Buddha's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience and was never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you, I make this request.